I like to argue that globalization is like a fast train, and you've got to build a platform to get the train to stop at your location. Not easy, but if you do, then you actually get very, very dramatic benefits.
Welcome to another podcast brought to you by the International Monetary Fund. I'm Bruce Edwards, and today we talk about value chains.
Hi, I'm David Dollar. I'm a senior fellow in the China Center at the Brookings Institution.
Global value chains break up the production process so that different steps can be carried out in different countries. Value chains allow countries to specialize in one or several activities in which it has comparative advantage. David Dollar says he's seen Asia's economies transformed by value chains in recent years. Before joining Brookings, he was country director for China and represented the U.S. Treasury in Beijing. Dollar's recent article on value chains, entitled Invisible Links, is published in the June 2019 edition of Finance and Development magazine. So how do value chains work?
Very simply, most modern products have long value chains. I like to think of it starting with someone's idea. If you think about some of the products that have really transformed our lives, like smartphones, someone came up with this idea, and often they patent it or they start producing it under a brand name. So think of some of the value that goes into the product, the brand, the trademark, or patents. And then most modern products have a mix of sophisticated inputs and more simple ones. Mm-hmm. So one thing that struck me is a lot of modern products involve the integration of advanced economies and developing economies. So you've got, for example, with smartphones, Taiwan produces some of the more sophisticated components, particularly advanced semiconductors, and they tend to then shoot off in all different directions. China is increasingly producing value added in what I think of as the middle of the value chain, kind of somewhat less sophisticated products, but more than just assembly, which is what they used to specialize in. And then China does a lot of assembly, but increasingly that's shifting to Vietnam, Bangladesh, countries that have lower wages than China. But then remember, most of this stuff ends up in Europe and the United States. So then we come back into the value chain. You've got shipping and insurance, and then you've got marketing and distribution. So if you actually look at a lot of long value chains, you start out with very sophisticated inputs from, say, the U.S., and then you have the other things I mentioned, and then eventually it comes back into the U.S., and again, you have relatively sophisticated distribution and sales.
And so how good are we at capturing the true value of these value chains in trade data? You know, like the data that economists use to spot imbalances, for example.
Right. So the traditional trade data is just looking at the gross value of trade. And what that means is when smartphone, the wholesale value when it comes in from China might be $200. That gets reported as a $200 export from China to the U.S., but it may very well have $25 of U.S. value added starting in that brands and patents. It's got some Taiwan value added. It may have been finally assembled in China plus some of the intermediate inputs. So the point of this whole new value chain strand of research is to break down the production, try to see where all the value added is coming from, which gives you a somewhat different perspective than those traditional trade statistics.
So do you think that if people were more aware of the actual value of global value chains, that there might be less anti-globalization sentiment out there, do you think?
Yeah, I think what one thing this means is that some of the positives for an advanced economy are not that visible. Mm-hmm. A lot of good jobs in science and technology, but also finance, a lot of those jobs, people are not necessarily aware that this is feeding into global production. They just see the product coming in from China, for example. A lot of the jobs that are being created in the advanced economies are in service sectors. Right. So I think people don't even think about that. We used to call services non-tradables, mm-hmm. right? And now what we're learning is they are almost half of the value added of global trade. So a lot of the jobs are being created in those service sectors, and it's just not that visible. Mm.
So what is the advantage of producing a product in this way, over countries developing manufacturing sectors that produce entire product lines in one location? What is the advantage of the value chain process?
Right. So I would argue there's an advantage both for the advanced economies and for the developing economies. The benefit for the developing economies is more obvious. Before there were global value chains, developing countries generally exported primary products, meaning, you know, bananas or iron ore. And to get into manufacturers without a value chain, you have to produce the whole thing.
Yeah.
And there was some exporting of things like clothing, which is relatively simple, but even that's more complicated than people realize. And then you want to move into almost anything else, and it's very complicated.
And expensive, right?
Yeah, and that's the right way to think about it. It may be in principle some of these poor countries could do it, but it would be so prohibitively expensive that they would not then be competitive on the global market. So it's a way for developing countries to get into manufacturers and services and diversify their exports, which we've seen very dramatically. Developing countries now mostly export value added from the manufacturing sector. But for rich countries, this is a way of exploiting the technologies and the brands that have been created in rich countries. It creates a lot of good jobs, but it also eliminates medium-skilled jobs, so it creates a certain adjustment problem. But overall, it makes us richer.
So in a sense, the advanced economies or the richer countries are taking advantage, really, of an opportunity to produce goods, perhaps at a lower cost, in less developed countries. Do we see wages at some point increase in those countries that are participating in value chains?
Yes, absolutely. And China is the most dramatic example of this. You know, for a long time, as China integrated with the global economy starting around 1978, for a long time, wages were pretty flat in China. It seemed that there was an infinite supply of labor coming from the countryside. But then that changed almost 20 years ago now. I moved to China in 2004 as the World Bank country director. And I witnessed very dramatic rise. We worked with the Chinese on a lot of household surveys, and so we had really quite good data on what was really happening. And real wages were going up at 7-8% per year for a long stretch of time. So now China is a high-wage producer in the developing world, so things moving out of China to Vietnam, Bangladesh, even Mexico has lower wages than China.
Wow. So how does all this cross-border traffic of materials and products, how is it affected by trade policy generally? I mean, like, how do trade barriers, for example, affect the global value chain ecosystem?
Right. So I would argue that protection is never a particularly good idea, even in the pre-value chain world. But with value chains, it's a particularly bad idea. A lot of what the U.S. imports from China, for example, consists of parts and components used by American firms. And actually, in these tariffs the U.S. has imposed on China, the administration has tried to avoid the popular consumer items. So actually, they focused on these parts and components. So what you're doing is you're taxing American firms who are using these as part of their production, and so you're hurting American firms. And it's very hard to predict, you know, what the specific effects are. Suppose you want to help Michigan. You might think that tariffs on autos, for example, is going to help Michigan. But with these value chains, it's so complex. You know, Michigan's getting a lot of value added from Mexico. They're actually importing a lot of parts from China. So you start interfering with these value chains, it's not at all obvious what's going to happen to Michigan production. The one thing we can be pretty sure about is that costs are finally going to go up for consumers, and they're going to buy fewer automobiles, and they're going to buy fewer smartphones, things like that. So there's a risk that it all backfires on the United States. Mm.
So what would you say are the countries that have benefited most from the global value chain system? And to what extent do you think that value chains are the answer for low-income countries that are looking to expand their economies?
Well, I've mentioned China, and that's in many ways the poster child for, you know, globalization, creating a lot of jobs, reducing poverty. But let's put China aside. Southeast Asia has about 600 million people. It's a very diverse area, but, you know, Vietnam is a spectacular success. I started going to Vietnam in 1989 for the World Bank, working with the IMF. Actually, we did a very good representative household survey in 1992, something I'm proud of. So we actually know the dramatic poverty reduction. It's gone from over 50% extreme poverty down to very low single digits today. Wow. So Vietnam definitely been successful. But a smaller country like Malaysia has benefited a lot. Indonesia is doing quite well now and integrating with value chains. Thailand, complicated country, but it's definitely had some success participating in this. And then Bangladesh, normally considered part of South Asia, but right next door to Southeast Asia. Bangladesh is quite a significant success story in certain sectors, garments, a few other areas, and they've also had very significant poverty reduction.
Now, do you see this new free trade agreement in sub-Saharan Africa as something that might open the door for some countries in that region to take advantage of the global value chain?
It's very encouraging. So Africa certainly needs more integration. It's broken up into more than 50 countries, and it's really not that big an economy. Mm-hmm. So definitely it would benefit from integration. We're starting to see a little bit of shifting of value chains. There's some Chinese investment going into Ethiopia, for example, in manufacturing. In this research project that resulted in these global value chains development reports, we're making a big effort to get more African data and include more African countries and researchers in the analysis. Because Africa is beginning to play, I don't think I would say significant, but they're playing more of a role in global value chains.
So there's obviously low-income countries obviously have a lot to gain by jumping into the value chain. But how do they overcome some of the inefficiencies in border regulations that we see in a lot of low-income countries?
Right. So a lot of the traditional problems and the traditional World Bank, IMF type of recommendations remain relevant. I would say even more relevant. So we've always it argued for countries to ease up on border controls, reduce the formal barriers like tariffs, but also focus on what we call trade facilitation, making it easy to move goods in and out. This is especially important in a value chain world because things might move in and out several times. So what we say is any problems at the border cascade. It may seem like a 10% problem, but if you go back and forth a few times, then it's a 50% problem. You have a 50% cost problem, you're out of the business completely. So a lot of what you need are really what I call the fundamentals. You need ease of trade going in and out. You have to keep corruption at ideally as low as possible. You need decent infrastructure. You need an educated labor force. So you've got a set of fundamentals. I like to argue that globalization is like a fast train, and you've got to build a platform to get the train to stop at your location. Not easy, but if you do, then you actually get very, very dramatic benefits.
Thank you so much.
Great to talk to you.
David Dollar is Senior Fellow at the China Center at the Brookings Institution and author of Invisible Links, published in the June 2019 edition of Finance and Development magazine. Go to imf.org/FND to find the magazine online or download the Finance and Development app to read it on your mobile device. David Dollar is also host of the Dollar and Cents podcast produced by Brookings. Check it out at brookings.edu. And if you like this podcast, subscribe on your favorite podcast app. Just search for IMF Podcasts. You can also follow us on Twitter @IMF_podcast. Thanks for listening.